Welcome to the Film Threat Podcast. This is Anthony Ray Bench, and Chris Gore is not with us, but we do have a fine guest. Please welcome Matt Kyle.
Hello. Hi, Matt. Hello, Anthony.
We are going to be seeing The Fate of the Furious, and I've never seen any of the other ones.
That is impressive to me. I've seen the whole series at least twice. I just watched all seven in story order, not release order, this weekend. So I'm fresh off the full series.
Because the timeline gets a little weird with Tokyo Drift, right?
Yes, Tokyo Drift, because it contained a character that everybody liked a lot, ended up being turned into, like, 4, 5, and 6 all take place before 3, so they could put that character into those movies.
I'm already confused. So before that, though, there's an independent movie because, you know, we are Film Threat and we do deal with independent movies. I watched Dara Jew last night, and it premiered at the South by Southwest Film Festival. I'll talk about it a little bit as I fumble through notes. We're doing this in a parking lot.
Film Threat's on the road this week in general.
Yeah, yeah. Chris Gore is at Star Wars Celebration, probably having a good time hanging out with the Ewoks and Jawas and stuff. Mm-hmm. That lucky bastard. But we're seeing The Fate of the Furious, so...
It's also not a bad deal.
Yeah, yeah, it's for free. It's a press screening.
And you don't know what you're walking into, but I do like these movies overall.
A lot of people do. A lot of people do. So anyways, Dara Jew is directed by Anthony Ona. He's a first-time director, at least as far as features go. It stars Ami Amin, and it's about the story of Shay, the son of a Nigerian immigrant. Shay has a strained relationship with his sister and mother on account of his father's dark secret. He's also struggling to advance his career and put some trust in his new girlfriend, Liz. It was a good movie, but the cast was just absolutely horrible, with the exception of the lead. Like, this was one of the worst casts I've seen in a film in a long, long time. Just everybody throughout the board was just awful and stiff and wooden.
So what buoyed it up to being enjoyable?
The cinematography, first off, was really notable. It takes place in New York, and the New York setting kind of does this really interesting thing where while you have the character of Shay dealing in New York and kind of trying to advance his career and kind of feeling isolated through some instances of racism, it's a very cool colored palette, like very, you know, cold blue and very kind of sterile. And when he's with his family, it's brighter, it's kind of warm orange and everything. And just that's something I picked up and I really liked. Again, Ami Amin is an amazing actor. He was in The Maze Runner and Sense 8, which I have not seen Sense 8, but I'm a pretty big fan of The Maze Runner. And he does a fantastic job. He's somebody that I would look out for. I think his career is just starting, and I think he's going to go places. I really like how the film deals with Shay's drug addiction. The film kind of starts out with him popping Adderall to try to kind of focus on his job and his projects and stuff. And it kind of spirals out of control towards the end. He gets into harder stuff, and I don't really want to spoil it, but it's kind of interesting to see that journey. And it's done in a very realistic and, like, I don't know if I know this is an autobiographical movie for the director and writer. I don't know if it's something he dealt with personally, but he knows his stuff on the subject of drug dependency. I really also liked the family dynamic. You have this character who just hates his father, and eventually they explain why in the movie, but you honestly get the feeling that there's just something awful that the father did, and you don't know what it is. His hatred towards his father affects the rest of the family as well. It puts a strain on his relationship with his mother and a strain on his relationship with his sister. The mother and father, they are really fantastic actors. Like I said, the rest of them are not. It's bad. It's so bad. Especially the character of Liz, played by Lucy Griffith. She was the actress that got cut from Constantine. Oh. She was supposed to be the lead character in that. And after the pilot, they gave her the boot. She never showed up again.
For that reason?
I tried looking into the reasoning, and it was all a bunch of nice studio fluff.
Mm.
Like, oh, she just didn't fit. I guarantee it's because she's a shitty actress. Yeah, that
pretty much means she's terrible.
Yeah. God, she was terrible.
Studio talk for we couldn't make it work.
Yeah, yeah. She from the back seat, she was also on True Blood. My girlfriend's here. Yeah. My girlfriend Megan's here, and Matt's girlfriend is here as well. There's also this character played by actor Peter Vack that is kind of this comic relief. And he is just so over the top and trying to be like Ryan Reynolds.
Mm.
And it's super embarrassing and just really cringeworthy. The script, I think it bites off a little bit more than it can chew. It tries to kind of jump all over the place, dealing with racism, but the instances of racism don't really lead anywhere as far as the finale of the film. Like, there isn't a realization, there isn't acceptance, there isn't conflict. It just kind of peters off. But the thing that it focuses the most on is the family stuff. He's basically becoming his father through making the same decisions that his father made that he's super critical over. And that's a really interesting dynamic for the film to kind of explore. The rest of it is basically like a remake of Wall Street, where he plays a financier. And he has some insider tips. Without like a Gordon Gekko character, this plot is really, really boring. the heart of the film is with the family dynamic. But anyways, that's what I thought of Dara Ju. I would recommend checking it out. I think for a first film, as far as the director Anthony Ohna goes, it's a decent outing. But hopefully next time he'll work with a better cast and just kind of focus on a tighter script. So back to The Fate of the Furious. As I mentioned before, I have never seen any of these. I was wondering if you can kind of bring me up to speed. Because, I know something about it. Yeah, yeah. This is seven movies of information. From what I gather, it's about...
I don't know if I call it information. But there's a lot of plot. As Joe Bob Briggs would have said, there's a whole lot of plot getting in the way of the story.
I love Joe Bob Briggs.
Fast and the Furious is a fascinating series because, for one thing, like, you watch the first movie, which came out in 2001, and I remember I watched the whole series for the first... Because I watched the first movie in the theaters, and I didn't go back.
Back in 2001, right?
Back in 2001.
Yeah.
And I didn't really go back until... Furious 6 was coming out, or Fast and Furious 6, depending on which title you believe.
And also, the titles are super confusing.
Titles are
too.
Very weird, yeah. And so, but I'd heard that 5 was good, and so 6 was going to be a thing, so I decided to catch up. So I watched 1 through 5, and the interesting... So this is right before 6, and I remember thinking how weird the first movie looked as a kind of this relic of the culture of 2001. Watching this now is like in 2001 watching a movie from 1989. I did the math, and it had been that when I saw Fast and Furious 1 in the theater, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade was as old as Fast and Furious 1 was now that I was rewatching it.
Oh, wow.
And how different it is. And the funny thing is, if you watch Fast and Furious 1 now, it's almost parody. Like, it's hilarious. Like, everybody's wearing their mesh shirts, and everybody's got their Junko jeans, and everybody... And, like, I remember going to see this in the theater, and nobody thought it was weird.
Yeah.
Like, none of this was weird. The fact that everybody's gathering in the streets and parking their cars near factories, and girls are walking around, like, almost half naked, and, like, watching everybody, like, work on their engines. I was like, oh, yeah, that's just what people
all
do in
LA.
All
the neon colors.
Yeah. Well, that's LA. Yeah. That's what you do. That's what you do on Friday. Yeah. It was just totally accepted. Now it's like this. It's not a great movie, but it's this fascinating sort of cultural relic, and it's interesting to watch this movie that is essentially a remake of Point Break. Paul Walker plays Brian O'Connor, and he is an undercover cop trying to infiltrate the racing scene in Los Angeles because street racer. There's a group of kind of disguised street racers that are stealing DVD players off of trucks and reselling them. It's like a heist thing. And so he gets involved with Vin Diesel's character's younger sister, Mia, Vin Diesel is like the king racer of the area because he's been not for any racing ability that you really see necessarily, but just because he's Vin Diesel, he kind of has to earn his way in, and then he like you know gets in. It's exactly like Point Break, except like instead of the bad performance being the undercover guy, it's the inside guy because Vin Diesel, much as I love the man, no Patrick Swayze.
No.
But that's essentially the story, and at the end, you know, Paul Walker's character gets totally absorbed in the culture and falls in love with the girl and lets Vin Diesel go, and that sort of sets the whole thing off. And then the series spends three movies trying to find itself, because the second one doesn't have Vin Diesel. It's just Paul Walker and Tyrese in Miami undercover for the FBI, under the auspices of the same guy that Paul Walker was working for in the first one. These movies have incredible continuity. That's one thing you should know. In the seventh movie, they brought back a character that was from the first movie that was the same actor.
Oh,
you
wow.
haven't seen him in 13 years, and all of a sudden he's back, and they're like, "Hey, Hector, how you doing?" It's like, it's amazing. It's got continuity that like Marvel movies would die for.
So from what I've gathered,
two is sort of a forgotten one.
Yeah.
Two is the one that like sort of two is kind of a throwaway picture with no Vin Diesel. The third movie was trying to capitalize on the drift racing scene, so it has no continuity with any of the characters. And you're going along with this like weird Texas guy who's played by an actor. I don't remember his name, but he's from he's from Friday Night Lights.
Yeah, he was also the kid that gets killed by the black oil
in X-Files.
X-Files. That's what I recognized him from.
And he ends up getting kicked out of the United States and going to Tokyo to live with his dad, and gets sucked into the drift racing scene along with Lil Bow Wow. Who has the ugliest car in the entire series. He has a like this boxy, I think it's a Scion or something, but it's like it's all done up like the Hulk. And
oh,
so
geez.
Like it's got like molded fists coming out of the doors, and it's horrific.
That's probably because Universal had rights to the characters and still kind of does.
So Tokyo Drift is the worst movie of the whole series. However, there are people who like it the best because it has the most actual racing in it. It has the most racing and the most accurate racing. They did a lot of like actual research and brought in real drift racers, and so it's a terrible movie, but it's actually got pretty good race sequences in it. So there you go. Now the trick to Tokyo Drift is it didn't do very well. It's the lowest grossing film of the whole series, but Vin Diesel did appear in the tag at the end.
Yeah,
because Han, who is famous as part of Vin Diesel's crew in the subsequent movies, became a very popular character. But Han is killed in Tokyo Drift. And
this is where the timeline gets
screwy.
Yeah.
So Vin Diesel shows up at the end of Tokyo Drift to race the American kid who's the new Drift King. Mm-hmm. And you're like, what's that about? And what it is about is Vin Diesel agreed to do it for no money in exchange for Universal giving him the rights to Riddick.
Yeah, I remember reading that.
So that's why he did that. But that kind of hung there for a long time, because 4, which is just Fast and Furious, brings back Paul Walker, Vin Diesel, Mia, Michelle Rodriguez, like the whole original crew, to sort of do this soft reboot, which brings them back into the fold, and like they have to go up. They go up against a like a kingpin in L.A. named Braga, while Vin Diesel is off doing his thing and trying to be like the lone wolf running from the law, Michelle Rodriguez's character, who's his like longtime girlfriend, gets killed by a henchman of Braga. And so he goes back to L.A. to take revenge and teams up back up with Paul Walker and sort of the family reforms. To give you an idea of what like the main themes of this series are, there was a drinking game when we were watching the whole series during the weekend. And the three things you had to drink during were NOS, which is nitrous oxide, which they use as their turbo boost.
Yeah.
NOS is a constant presence in the series. Gratuitous ass shots, which are also a constant presence. And anytime anyone mentions the word family.
Oh, geez.
And the funny...
Just for the trailers that I've seen alone, like
family.
The word family is
oh,
just
yeah.
Like,
see, the thing
oh,
is,
God.
As you go further into the series, the family instances go up and the ass instances go down.
I hope you guys
but the NOS remains constant
during that.
The fourth movie really doesn't go anywhere except... It gets everybody back together. Now, Fast 5 is where everything changes. Because at some point, Diesel wanted to do 4 and 5 back-to-back. Universal wouldn't let him because the third movie didn't do very well. So they're like, just do the fourth one and we'll see. The fourth one became Universal's biggest opening weekend ever.
Oh, wow.
Breaking a record that was set by the Lost World Jurassic Park almost 10 years earlier. So they got to do a five. And five is where director Justin Lin figured out, if we just make this a heist picture, if we basically just make this James Bond with racing, we got something good. And sure enough, Fast Five is not just the best movie in the Fast and the Furious series. I would say it's the best action movie of the 21st century so far.
Oh, wow.
It is phenomenally good.
Wow.
And they also moved away from all the CG car stuff, and it's all real car stunts. There are just some top level action sequences in this movie, and it really hones in on the family thing, which is like cheesy, but it works because it's the thing about it is it's not done with any cynicism. It's not done with like kind of hot. It's not like a Michael Bay Transformers movie where you feel kind of like the movie's like mocking you for watching it to some degree. You know, you feel like the people who made this movie are kind of be like, ah, you're an idiot. You don't know any better. You're watching this movie. Screw you. We're just going to do whatever we want. There's a genuine affection for the characters in the Fast and the Furious movies. They're very earnest films, and that kind of just makes it somehow work. And the fact that Vin Diesel and Paul Walker have really good on-screen chemistry, like the love story really is between the two of them, not Paul Walker and Vin Diesel's sister, when
it's
you really
get down
to it. It's a serious bromance. And they bring everybody back from the previous movies. Like, they have to assemble their team. And so 4, 5, and 6 actually take place before Tokyo Drift. So they could bring Han, the character who died in 3, into the team, so he gets to be part of the team. And so now you've got all these characters from all this, like all these movies that have come before, and they're all back together, and it's great. And the funny thing was, I didn't like 2 at all when I watched it the first time, and rewatching it this time, I liked it better because now I have more affection for Paul Walker and Tyrese's characters from the later films. So I was more engaged in the second movie because of what the later movies did. So Fast, and also the Fast Five introduced The Rock as Agent Hobbs, which is key because The Rock is, I think, what really makes these movies an international hit.
Yeah,
he has just incredible appeal, and he just strikes the perfect balance between intensity and like self-parody, and it just all works. And then so they've continued that trend since then. Fast and Furious 6 was similar. It also started the trend of whoever they fight in the previous movie becomes part of the family in the second movie. So Hobbs joins them, and it becomes a whole thing. And then at the end of 6, you're still kind of wondering like what's going on with Tokyo Drift. The end of 6, the Sting catches up to Tokyo Drift, and then the scene where Vin Diesel races the new Drift King in Tokyo Drift at the end is actually in and paid off in 7.
Oh wow!
So almost a decade later, they finally caught up to it, and now Fate of the Furious, the 8th movie, is kind of the first time we've really moved beyond where Tokyo Drift had taken us back in the mid-2000s.
You know, I never really had any interest in checking these movies out, and I think, like, today, seeing the Fate of the Furious will be kind of an indicator. I've never jumped into a series this far along. Well, maybe, like, James Bond, but those aren't really, you know,
yeah, there's no continuity connected. There, really, minus a couple of them.
Yeah, but
there aren't many series long enough that you could jump in.
That's very true. Yeah, Star Wars is kind of getting
Star Wars or like Harry Potter, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing, once you hit 5, to some degree 4, but definitely 5. Once you hit 5, these are superhero movies. Just think of the cars as Iron Man armor. When they're in the cars, they're invincible.
That's something you said at WonderCon, which,
yes,
you know, it made me, because we were both on the WonderCon panel, it made me actually kind of curious, like, to put it that way, like, I'm a big superhero fan.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the Fast and the Furious franchise has always been about cars, and I'm not a big car guy. Like, I know more about the Millennium Falcon than I know the car we're sitting in right now.
The funny thing is, car guys, their main complaint about this series is it's not about cars.
Really?
Only 3 really deals heavily with cars and car racing.
See, that speaks to my ignorance.
Otherwise, it's an action franchise that happens to use racing to solve problems, and then after 4, there are no races. There are actually scenes in 5 where they race to accomplish something, and you don't see the race because they win. Like, there's no reason to show Vin Diesel racing anyone because you know he wins. So the only time you ever see races after 4 are when they're a character-driven necessary moment. So that kind of gratuitous like car porn goes completely out the window, and instead the cars are essentially what Q gadgets would be in a Bond movie.
See, I I can get behind that. That sounds really cool.
It's real, and like I said, very continuity heavy. There are callbacks in these movies that go back 10 years sometimes. I think it's an impressive piece of work, and I certainly have never seen. I can't think of another movie series that reinvented itself that late and became so successful for doing so. I do have a really kind of irrational affection for these movies. They're just a ton of fun, and they're incredibly stupid. I mean, Vin Diesel gets shot at least twice in these films,
oh, wow,
and never reacts. It's like Greek mythology, where like a random soldier could not hurt Achilles.
Mm.
There's a theory that we came up with, rather drunk, that Vin Diesel actually is Achilles, and the reason no one can hurt him is no one's hit him in the heel.
Mm.
And the 10th movie is going to be where they finally get time travel and they have to go back to ancient Greece, and they ask Vin Diesel, why do we have to go back to ancient Greece? And Vin Diesel goes, we got to pick me up. and that's where he comes from. If you think about it like that, if you think about like, Vin Diesel got shot in the shoulder, but it didn't hurt him because it wasn't a major character who did it, because it's like Greek mythology, yeah, where like, you can't injure the heroes like that, you know? Or it's like in Lord of the Rings, where like Gimli, Legolas, and Aragorn can run for 4 days straight chasing the hobbits to Isengard because they're mythic heroes, and that's what mythic heroes can do.
Yeah.
Like, that's basically what's happening here. Whereas, you know, if Jason Statham or The Rock hits Vin Diesel with a tire iron, he feels it. If a random guy hits Vin Diesel with a tire iron, and this happens, he blocks it with his hand and doesn't feel anything.
See, it's interesting that you bring up the time travel stuff, and you mentioned that you worked on a spec script where it combined the Transformers,
yes,
with Fast and the Furious. Do you think they will ever go into those kind of not ridiculous scenarios, but kind of?
Well, they did ask the writer about this, I think last week, and he said that he is completely open to them going into space.
Wow. Okay, I would be on board. Like, to be honest, you are swaying my opinion on the franchise, especially because you just flat out said it's not car porn. Mm-hmm. And, you know, superheroes.
Earlier on, it's more car porn. As soon as you hit five is a James Bond film, basically.
And I'm on board with that, and I am excited now. If I enjoy this movie.
I don't know if this one's going to be as good, because I think 5, 6, 7, I think they've gone down.
Mm-hmm.
I think 5 is amazing. 6 is great. 7's really good, but it's sort of, they're losing the thread a little bit, and I'm curious to see how a non-Paul Walker movie, you know, without the Diesel Walker bromance, I mean, I don't know how you're going to flip this, really, because that's the heart of the series so much.
Yeah, well, according to the trailers, they're kind of making Vin Diesel a bad guy. Right. I don't buy it.
But what's the only reason Vin Diesel could betray his family?
Yeah.
Family.
Ah.
So there's some reason. His family's not going to be... he's saving his family by betraying his family. I'm calling that right now. I have no information on this movie whatsoever. I've barely even seen half a trailer. But I know that the only reason Vin Diesel would ever betray his family is to save his family. That's this series in a nutshell right there.
There you go. I would be completely remiss to not ask you about Transformers, because you are the Transformers guru, according to many people I've talked to. So... The Last Knight is coming out in a couple of months, I guess.
Yeah, July.
Yeah, you said something interesting on the panel where you could tell a lot from somebody's character by the Transformers movie they prefer.
Mm-hmm. Which sequel you prefer.
Yeah, yeah.
Every Transformers sequel is terrible for a different reason, and it's like a little kind of Rorschach test, like as to which one you think is the worst.
We are going to test that, because I prefer, I haven't seen the one that came out before last night, Extinction.
Age of Extinction, yeah.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. I watched a little bit of it, and I honestly fell asleep.
Age of Extinction is terrible, and one of the ways it's uniquely terrible is the worst paced of all of them.
Yeah.
I have never thought, well, this has to be over so many times in a movie in my life than watching Age of Extinction. Especially because I think it was like 11 p.m. or like a midnight show, and I was tired, and I kept thinking this has to be over. And like I would always think this has to be almost over. And then I think it can't be over. They haven't even gotten to China yet, and none of the Dinobots have shown up. Like, I know it can't be. And it just kept going on and on and on.
I remember I bought it. I didn't see it in theaters. But I bought it, and I'm watching it, and I'm just like, when the hell are the robots going to show up? I'm tired of listening to Marky Mark talk about his underage daughter dating some dude that's, you know,
yeah, that's really the
18.
Whole thrust of the whole thing is like, it's like, we're going to take this movie that ostensibly is to sell toys of robots to children and turn like the first act into an extended statutory rape joke. Because that's I'm sure that's what Hasbro loves to see their toys associated with and can't say anything because Michael Bay has full creative control. Because even if you're a massive toy company, I'm sure you can't just go in and tell the guy that made you $4 billion.
Yeah.
Like, hey, don't do it that way. Because he's like, hey, the second one had like racist twin robots and a bunch of pot brownie jokes, and that worked fine. Shut up, you know?
You know, I got to say the second one is my least favorite. Out of the three that I've seen, I enjoyed the third one the most. So what does that say about me?
That says that you like the one that's the closest to an actual functional movie.
Ah.
I mean, I think the first one's probably the best if you take the DoD hacker subplot out. Like, you got a pretty lean summer movie there. Of the three sequels, Dark of the Moon is just an overplotted mess.
Mm-hmm.
That's really all it is. And it's also the one that really introduces the idea of psychotic Optimus Prime. Because Optimus Prime in the Bay movies has gotten progressively more terrifying as a kind of a psycho murderer. Because he started as more of like a noble warrior, and then like he just started taking faces off and executing guys, you know, executes that one Decepticon at the beginning of Revenge of the Fallen, like with a double tap to the head. And then at the end of it, flies up to the Fallen and screams, "Give me your face," which is a very famous, I think we're going off the rails line. And the Dark of the Moon, like, is more or less, it's a kind of a competent-ish story. Until the very end when Leonard Nimoy betrays them all. And then, like, in the very end, like, Optimus Prime lets Chicago die to prove a point. And then he murders Leonard Nimoy robot as he crawls away begging for mercy. And then he disarms Megatron and blows his face off out of nowhere and says, "Let's find out what it's like to live without you."
Yeah.
And then turns back and says, like, "We will never again abandon our human allies," directed by Michael Bay. Like, it's over. Like, Michael Bay does not believe in denouement at all. And so I would say that Dark of the Moon, if you like Dark of the Moon best, to me that says that you recognize that Dark of the Moon is the only one that tries.
Fair enough.
Whereas Revenge of the Fallen is probably the worst. I mean, Revenge of the Fallen is practically a montage.
Yeah.
The writer's strike was on. Michael Bay made up a bunch of scenes he wanted to do, and nobody ever bothered to connect them up.
Racist robots.
There's the Decepticon girl who looks exactly like a normal human being and tries to seduce Shia LaBeouf, and then like the Terminator scorpion tail comes out of her thong and stuff. And because, you know, basically that character exists because that's the shot Michael Bay wanted, right?
Yeah.
But then like she tries to chase them and they run her over with a car and stuff, and then you're like, hey, if the Decepticons can look like human beings, that completely changes everything, and then it's never mentioned again.
Yeah.
And then there's the whole thing with the Devastator's giant wrecking ball testicles. Geez,
I forgot about that.
I mean, it's a really unpleasant, haphazard. I mean, there's a scene where they're in the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum, and they go outside, and they're in the Arizona C-17 Boneyard Desert. Mm. I mean, the naked contempt for the audience's intelligence in Revenge of the Fallen is astounding. The end credits really should have just been Michael Bay holding a middle finger up to the lens. Like that, I mean, that's really what it is. Age of Extinction, I think I like that one less because it's just grosser. Not just in terms of all the weird underage sex humor, but like it's the first one where all the robots really felt horrible people.
Mm-hmm.
And like you didn't want to spend any time with them, and they're all kind of assholes. And it's just a thoroughly unpleasant film, and it's incredibly long, and you just don't understand why you're there.
Yeah, I got to tell you a story about Revenge of the Fallen. I saw the movie at a midnight screening for opening day, and I'm watching it, and I'm just like, because I like the first one. I don't think it's a masterpiece or anything, but I enjoyed it, and I was interested in seeing
moments.
The second one. Yeah, so I'm watching it, and the projector literally melts the film. And it was the coolest, like, me being a film geek, like, I'd never seen it before. And it was the coolest thing that, like, I was more geeked out about that than I was the movie. And everybody was like, "Oh, I want a refund. Like, this is such a bummer. Like, I'm going to have to catch it tomorrow, but I work tomorrow." And I was just like, I literally felt saved by, like,
That didn't. I drove down to San Diego to see it.
Oh, geez.
So for a midnight screening IMAX. I remember the two things I remember about it was just like, whoa, what the hell? And I remember walking out, and someone in front of me said, "That's the best movie I've ever seen in my life."
Oh gosh.
And I couldn't. When I saw Dark of the Moon, though, speaking of film breaking stuff, we saw it in IMAX 3D. And about halfway through the movie, the 3D stopped working.
Oh.
Like, one eye just went black in the active 3D goggles. And you had to take them off and watch it in 2D. And then right about as the big final battle was starting, the red stopped working.
Mm-hmm.
So, the red, green, blue, 3D, the red stopped. So, everything was, Optimus Prime was suddenly green and purple. And so, we watched the rest of that movie like that. And it was kind of, it was fitting, I guess, that everything just broke. And then they handed they didn't even question it. Like, everybody, they just stood at the front of the theater and handed everybody free tickets, ticket vouchers after that.
Another thing I want to bring up is back in January, director DJ Caruso, who was tapped to direct G.I. Joe 3, another Hasbro property, mentioned that he was going to combine, that was the movie that was going to combine the Transformers universe with the G.I. Joe universe. Mm. Is that something you at any point want to see? Or do you think that Transformers should be kind of a separate?
I am entirely happy with Transformers being part of a larger Hasbro cinematic thing.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is not the idea of crossing these properties over. The problem is that Michael Bay is terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm actually interested in the fact that he says there's 14 more story pitches ready for a yearly cinematic universe thing, because he can't direct all of those. So a couple of them are going to probably be good, at least by accident. Right?
Yeah, we can hope.
I think they missed the boat to some degree, where I think they should have made Josh Duhamel and his little military team, they should have become G.I. Joe.
Yeah, oh, that wouldn't be
cool. In the second movie, the second movie they were Nest or whatever, but then they could have spun out as G.I. Joe after that. And then technically they would have almost beat Marvel to the punch in terms of cinematic universe stuff, which maybe that's for the best, because you probably want good movies doing that. But I think it's a no-brainer to do that and bring in Mask and bring in humanoids and all that. Sure, great. But you want to do that? I think more power to you, because no one else has really duplicated Marvel's success. And maybe someone in there's got a good idea for a G.I. Joe movie. I don't know, but giant robots can't hurt.
Well, recently, somebody from Hasbro let loose that they are rebooting G.I. Joe, and they're taking a millennial approach.
I have no idea what that means.
What the hell does that mean?
What?
Yeah.
A millennial
approach. Are they going to just bitch about problems and not have jobs?
I don't know. I mean, I guess, all the orders will come through Twitter. I don't know.
Yeah.
Or Tumblr? I don't know. I feel like a wacky, personality-filled, codenamed romp of kind of wacky personalities, fighting, faceless terrorist organizations is a hard sell in a post-9/11 world.
Yeah.
Hasbro struggled to reinvent G.I. Joe, the real American hero idea for an international market as well, because the jingoism doesn't really fly internationally, and you need these things to be international hits now.
Yeah.
So basically, you got to find a way to make G.I. Joe play in China.
I just don't want them to be a Last Starfighter thing where it's oh, I was really good at Call of Duty and now I'm getting called up to be on this task force because I'm a millennial and, millennials.
I don't know. Reshot those things for the second G.I. Joe movie with more, when they decided they needed more Channing Tatum, the shots they shot were him and The Rock playing Call of Duty together.
That's very true. I didn't mind that movie too much.
That was a G.I. Joe movie.
Yes.
That was more of
a
G.I. Joe movie than any of the Transformers movies have been Transformers movies.
I agree wholeheartedly. Anyways, we better get to the movie.
Yeah, we got carried away with all these Fast and the Furiouses. Did want to bring up that you mentioned Dara Ju used the warm family scenes to contrast with the colder blue scenes. Fast and the Furious is the exact same thing.
Really?
Where all the family stuff is warm and orange lit, and every time they're working with the federal agencies or the FBI, it's all blue, like Terminator James Cameron lighting.
Yeah, yeah.
Because where home is where everybody wants to be, and every time Paul Walker's character is working for the FBI, it's all blue lit and he's in a suit and he looks uncomfortable, and it's just you're not home, Paul Walker. Go home, Paul Walker.
It's the teal coloring.
Yes.
The trailer for Thor Ragnarok just dropped, and they also revealed a poster, and the director of the film tweeted out something where it was just like, teal and orange is dead. Long live orange, blue, pink, and like all the other vibrant colors. And it made me laugh because I was going through, like, I did a Google search for orange and teal movie posters. And for like the past 20 years, like, they have all been orange and teal. Oh, yeah. From The Dark Knight, like, Collateral. Like, it, yeah, it made me laugh.
I mean, it's a basic color contrast, but like, Hollywood's been leaning on it pretty hard.
Yep. All right, well, we are on our way to see The Fate of the Furious, and we'll let you know what we think afterwards. So we just got out of The Fate of the Furious, and...
Wait, still happening.
we're back in the parking lot and back in my car. Matt, what did you think?
I really liked it. It's, you know, the Fast and Furious movies are, when they're firing on all cylinders, they are some of the best dumb fun blockbuster movie making you got going nowadays. The one thing I will say is this movie really assumes you've seen the other movies. There is some serious continuity happening here, and I'm very interested to know what it was like for someone who has no idea who any of these people are, because this movie is not here to help you.
Yeah, you know, as previously mentioned, haven't seen any of the other seven. I had a hard time, like, connecting with the characters and actually caring about them.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know anything about Ludacris's character or Tyrese's character, from what I gather. Ludacris is a hacker.
Yes.
And a really good one. They have kind of a love triangle with
the other hacker.
Yeah.
Ramsey. She's only been in it since the previous movie.
Okay.
So
she's relatively new.
She's new.
Yeah. It just... The only characters I like found myself enjoying and like I was kind of bummed when they would leave was Jason Statham and The Rock. Like, I thought their little back and forth was really, really fun.
Yeah, The Rock is the anchor of this series in its, you know, super spy international heist team reinvention since 5. Like, I know there's been tension between him and Diesel, because Vin Diesel sort of is very protective of this series, and The Rock doesn't have to take that stuff, because mm-hmm. Everyone else doesn't seem to have a problem, or if they do, they don't say anything, but The Rock doesn't need the job.
Yeah.
So it seems like The Rock's willing to kind of call some stuff out. I do think Vin Diesel should be careful if that is true, if that is a thing that's actually happening, because I think The Rock is what makes this movie an international, like, phenomenon to a large degree. He is definitely the character you want to see walk on screen in every scene. Statham had almost no character development in the previous movie, which where he was the big villain. And they really turned him into, like, because there's a real question here where, like, you know, Statham killed one of their people a few movies ago. Tried to kill him through all of 7, and
it's not really brought up at all.
No, it's not really mentioned too much, and they got to find a way to make it okay for that character to have dinner with the family at the end of the movie, and they kind of get there. Like,
yeah.
In reality, you probably wouldn't do that with the guy who killed one of your friends, but like, in the context of the big dumb action movie, like, he does what he has to do, and he makes the right characters grin at him, and like, you know, by the end, you're like, yeah, okay. Like, he can say grace. It's fine, you know? It helps that they, like, introduce the idea that he's ex-British military.
Mm.
And, like, there's kind of an implication of, like, yeah, I did some nasty stuff, like, kind of like the way you guys break the law every other movie in the name of, like, national security, and no one knows why you did what you did. It's like, they draw a parallel between him and them and, like, and make it... They really, you know... delineate the idea that he tried to kill them specifically because of family ties, and then that like kind of comes back around again as part of the a part of a subplot that turns out to be a major element in the resolution of the film. It's it was a tough obstacle course, but I think they got there, and it helps that Statham is such a watchable actor. I think if you had a lesser actor in that role, it would not have sold but I feel like Statham got it there.
Yeah, I think Statham was my favorite part of the movie, and it's kind of a shame that, you know, he kind of leaves for a bit and comes back at the end. I think the movie sorely missed him. So it's interesting that you brought up the Vin Diesel and Dwayne Johnson feud. I want to touch on that a little bit because I agree. I think we're seeing like a shift because aside from Guardians of the Galaxy, Vin Diesel's career really kind of stalled.
Yeah.
And for a while he was saying, you know, I'm not going to do any sequels. Like I'm adamantly not doing a sequel. And we all know that he did Chronicles of Riddick and he ended up coming back to the Fast and Furious franchise. But it's interesting to see, like, you know, XXX 2 or I guess 3 came out this year. It's interesting to see him go kind of back to the well. And I'm wondering if it's because his career didn't pan out, because of him going outside of his comfort zone with other movie genres not, I guess, elevating him beyond just a dumb action movie star. I don't know.
Well, I do think what's happening, I think, like, Fast and the Furious is by far his most successful franchise, and he does have some ownership of it. Like, he is one of, you know, it has made him a very rich man.
Okay.
He's very successful because of it. I do feel like it might be his third choice of his franchises he's worked on, because he's a giant nerd. Yeah. And, you know, D&D fan, video game fan, like, loves science fiction, loves all that stuff.
He made a movie based on his D&D character.
Yeah, The Last Witch Hunter is based on his D&D character. Riddick is very close to his heart. David Toohey, the Pitch Black writer that he worked with to write the rest of the Riddick scripts, one of which is supposedly still under lock and key that no one has seen because they wrote a trilogy and locked them up in separate briefcases and told the studio that they'll get the keys to the other briefcases as needed as the series continues.
I didn't know that.
But I feel like he would prefer if Riddick or Last Witch Hunter had become the big hit, but Fast and the Furious is the big hit, so that's what he does.
Yeah.
And to be fair, I don't think that comes through in the movies. I think he does a very good job keeping them kind of true to the characters, and there's a lot of character shorthand in this film. Like, no one's introduced, no one's, like, you know, they there's no gather the team scene, there's no, it's like just everybody's in the room and here we go, because we've seen this four times already and we don't need to be introduced to these people unless you've never seen one before. So it's it's kind of like stepping, you know, it's probably like if Captain America Civil War was your first Marvel movie. It's like, who are these people? Like, there's a shorthand to it where they're like, we get it. Like, we know what we're here for. We're just going to get on with it.
Yeah.
And that's not really a great place to start. I thought there might be a little more easing in on this one because it's sort of the start of a new trilogy, 8, 9, 10. But nope. Nothing like that. So, but I think Diesel, this is his baby now because it's the one that took off and he came back to it and sort of helped whip it into shape, starting with 4 and definitely with 5. So I would think maybe he's, you know, he'll remain disappointed that some of his favorite ideas didn't become as big as this, but, you know, you can't really argue with a hit that makes you this big of a deal.
I mean, these movies are mega hits.
Yeah. International sensations.
Yeah.
I think they're projecting almost a $400 million worldwide opening for this one.
I believe it.
And word is that this one actually cost $250 million.
Oh, geez.
I believe it's the largest budget ever given to a non-white director.
Oh, wow.
And almost every dollar of it is up on the screen. I mean, this thing, like, it just never stops throwing stuff at you. I think the break, there's a bit more breakneck pacing in this one. It doesn't really stop for breath. Part of the problem with 7 was there's a point in 7, like right at the beginning of Act 3, where it kind of feels like they've solved the problem. And then they're like, well,
we got to do this now. And like act three just sort of happens. It feels it's a great sequence, but it feels tacked on. This movie has much better coherence in that regard, and the stakes are better.
Do you think the previous film was that way because of the Paul Walker incident?
A little bit, but like Paul Walker's character doesn't have a ton to do with the Jason Statham like conflict part, and finding the whole thrust of the last one was finding the God Eye, the surveillance program that can find anybody in the world, which plays very heavily into this movie mm-hmm. as well. Almost every character, major character and villain from the previous films is referenced in this movie. It even if it's just like a little dossier picture that comes up, they hit everyone. Whole lot of people must have gotten a little residual payout for this film because there's likeness rights thrown all over the place. But at the end of like that, basically the second act of Seven, it really kind of feels like, well, you're kind of done, except you have to like kind of take care of Jason Statham and his like henchmen people. And they come up with a really convoluted, but like action sequence friendly way to do that. Where it's just like, basically it's like, well, we got to shut him down, but he has to be within a certain distance to shut him down. So we have to lure him to Los Angeles and have this huge chase where Ramsey is the hacker that can shut down the God Eye. So that's who they're passing around between cars, like a hot potato. And Jason Statham's like the warlord that he's working with, like brings in like an attack helicopter, and they're like sending Predator drones down Wilshire Boulevard and blowing up downtown Los Angeles. And it's just crazy. Like mm-hmm. But the whole time you're kind of thinking like, wait, but then what? Like, what are you doing? And, like, there's never any question like that in this movie where it's like you always know what they're trying to do, even if what they're trying to do is sort of like, I don't know if that's really the way to go about it. But, you know, there's a whole sequence at the end where they're trying to do a thing where it feels like maybe you should split up because, like, the problem is everybody's shooting at you and they can't shoot at everybody. So everybody split up and come back to where you need to get. But similar to the very famous end of Six, there's a chase on a runway with trying to stop a giant plane from taking off. And I think it lasts about 20 minutes. Mm. And I believe someone calculated that the runway would have to be like 10 miles long for this to actually happen. And so conveniently in this, the big finale, they say it's 10 miles to get to this place we need to get. Let's go. And so, like, they're just driving for the next 20 minutes of film time. And you're like, all right, now it means 10 miles. They got to drive 10 miles. So it's a long way, and it's on ice. But I was pretty happy with it overall. It's not on par with Five, which is just fantastic, and just a really tight film. Maybe on par with Six. I don't mean Six would be my number two rank in the series, so this is probably like number three ish. I think it's better than Seven, it's better than One, and I don't really like the other three, so there you go.
Okay, I have a very stupid question, I guess. Is The Rock's character, I guess, Hobbs, right?
Yeah.
Is he like a genetically modified like
no,
super soldier?
No, not canonically, but like okay. I said, these are superhero movies.
Yeah, because he was doing stuff where I'm like, no human being should be able to do that.
Well, no, but remember what I said. If it's not a major character doing it to him, he can't be hurt.
Yeah.
And that's true. There's a prison break sequence where like characters whose names we don't know are shooting him with rubber bullets, and he's just like, big mistake. And they're just not doing. And then he gets in a fight with Jason Statham and it hurts him.
Yeah.
Because Jason Statham is an important character. That's just how these movies have decided they're going to work. And of course, like I said, you have to think of the cars as Iron Man armor. If they're in the car, they're invincible.
Ah.
Unless the motor dies. Like, that's basically what's happening there. And, you know, that's why, like, you know, there's a scene where, you know, they're doing crazy stuff and jumping through explosions and doing all this stuff. And then like suddenly Vin Diesel's in trouble because he has to bail out of his car.
Mm-hmm.
And if he's not in his car, he's not invincible anymore. And for a while there, it looked like he, you know, at one point when he like leveled up in one of the sequels, he'd taken some kind of, you know, he'd taken like a bonus skill that let him stay invincible for about 10 seconds after he gets out of the car. But apparently that must be gone now because everybody's very worried as soon as he gets out of the car. Normally he would have about 10 seconds of invulnerability after he bails out. That's kind of how it's been before, because usually he bails out when a car's going about 80 and just stands up.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it's like a Grand Theft Auto game, kind of. What did you think of Charlize Theron as the James Bond hacker villain from Tomorrow Never Dies reimagined?
I kind of dug her. I didn't buy her motivations. I think that's such a cop-out. Like, I miss when, like, during the 90s and more specifically the 80s, where bad guys were just bad guys that wanted to create carnage and that wanted to, you know, just kill people. And now everything is like, no, I want order. I want, you know, to start an incident that creates another incident.
And she like wants to hold the world. She wants to have nuclear capability so she can hold the world responsible for whatever she deems a bad decision on the part of superpowers or something. Like, I mean, it is kind of a tradition that bad guy, the real bad guys in these movies don't want anything as simple as money.
Mm-hmm.
They want some kind of something beyond that. It was a weird, I mean, you also, like, you can't think about that too much because you end up in the realm of like, well, no one should have that kind of power. But then you think about it and you're like, this is a group of, I mean, originally, thieves, you know, highway bandits who have continually gotten away with literal murder. I mean, at the end of 5, I think the Madrid Police Department is down about 90% of its officers.
Wow.
They kill people constantly in these movies. And I mean, in a couple of the chases in this, like, there's some car wrecks that happen in every one of these movies where you're like, they're dead.
Yeah.
He's dead. That guy's dead, you know. And a lot of it is like civilians. You know, there's a lot of civilian, not as much in this one, but a couple of, so it's like, if you really step back and like look at it from like a, like, I'm not invested with these characters thing, these are all really horrible people. Like, they've done some really bad shit. Like Vin Diesel's character alone has probably personally been responsible for the deaths of a couple hundred people in this series. And,
jeez.
You know, at a certain point, you're kind of like, is what Charlize Theron doing really that horrible compared to what the protagonists have gotten away with for 8 movies? Not really. But it doesn't matter because that's not what we're here for. We're not here to think about that. It's like, you know, you want to give her like a believable motivation, but you make her evil because she's like threatening a baby. It's like, I mean, she's literally threatening a baby. Like, that's how you know she's bad. Is because she's threatening a baby, and she talks real quiet, and she's prettier than everybody else.
Yeah, like, her dreads were terrible, though.
Yeah, it was not a great... I mean, should have probably stuck with the Furiosa hair.
Yeah, so I have another question, you know, because I don't really have a frame of reference. It seems like they're trying to tie her in with the other villains of the franchise, kind of like in almost a Spectre-type way with... With, you know, James Bond and Blofeld, you know, where, like, Inspector, he was like, I'm responsible for all of this, ha, ha, ha. Is, like, that something I just kind of, like, is that true?
Apparently. Like, this is the first we've heard of that in this movie. So, like,
so Cypher isn't recognized.
Cypher has never been mentioned before, as to my recollection. Like, the implication, they outright state it, that... Jason Statham's character was originally a... So in 6, Luke Evans?
Yeah.
Luke Evans, who turns out to be Jason Statham's younger brother, which is why Jason Statham wants to kill them in 7.
Yeah.
So he is trying to get this, like, super EMP thing called the Night something. The Night... That basically it's an EMP that can like blow out an entire city, which I believe they actually steal and use in this. Like, I think that's what the EMP they steal in this, or it's related. So there's like one component left he needs, and they have to stop him from getting that component. And it's said in this one that originally Cypher's the one who wanted that weapon. And she went to Jason Statham first, and he said no. And so she went to Statham's younger brother, and he was dumb enough to say yes. So
yeah, that all went the over my head.
So all the events of 6 and 7 were precipitated by Cypher, which is one of the main reasons why everybody can agree to get on the same side and screw her over in this one. It's crazy to look back at where they started, because the first movie is literally about people who live in, like, you know, downtown L.A., just south and east of downtown L.A., and race, like, you know, modded cars at night, and work in a restaurant slash garage during the day, and steal DVD players when they need money. Like, that's what that movie's about. And the undercover cop that ruins everything. And then, you know, progressively more undercover crazy stuff and drug dealers and organized crime. And then The Rock brings in sort of the international task force stuff. And then they're dealing with, you know, like world conquering, like, you know, weaponry and spy stuff. And then Statham is like beyond anything they've ever faced. And now we're working with, like, you know, like the greatest hacker in the world trying to, you know, start World War III. And so it's amazing that you start, I mean, the stakes and the scope have started real small and got real big.
Yeah.
And it kind of just feels like at this point, like I said, like the writer said he's open to taking them to space. Like, it feels like that would be a pretty natural progression from here. You know, like, I feel like next movie or 10, like, you could get them there and not have it feel too crazy in terms of, you know, the kind of the upward curve of this series.
So there is definitely a nod to Paul Walker's character in this. We won't spoil it. But do you think it was kind of hokey, or do you think it was appropriate?
I mean, I saw it coming from the instant.
Yeah, I did, too.
You know, it was introduced, but, like, it was nice. You know, it's nice. And it's also, I think, it's a reference to a real life thing as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I see where they're going with it. And it was nice to have in there. It feels like these movies are going to pay tribute to Paul Walker permanently anyway, you know, continually.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty much okay with that. Like, at some point they're going to call, you know, they're going to go into space and, you know, Dom's going to name, like, the moon they colonize, you know, Brian or something. It's you know, it's just, he's going to name, like, a comet O'Connor before he slams it into the enemy space station. Riding it with reins made of chains that he built from an engine.
That sounds like an awesome movie. I can't wait to see that one. Do you think that's going to be, like, Fast 12 or?
No, I think they'll get to that in either the next one or the one after.
Really, that quick?
I think they got 2 left in them at this point before they have to start waiting for the next generation to take over. I will say this, Fast, the second one, the next one, 9, it's just the 9 is going to be made out of the O in Furious. It's just like the top of the O is going to be the top of the 9, and the tail is just going to come down like skid marks. And that's going to be it. And then for the 10th one, it'll be the I and the O in Furious are the 1 and the 0. But the tagline is going to be, Fast 10, your seatbelt. You're welcome, Universal. You can use that for free.
God, I hope they do that. I hope. Like, if that happens, I'm going to text you and just take a picture next to it. So as a person and a fan familiar with the series, you give it your thumbs up, you know, 5 stars. For me, I think, you know, it's exactly like you said, there just wasn't enough of an introduction. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's understandable. It's the 8th movie of the franchise. So I would give it a recommendation not to see it if you're new. Start from, yeah, I guess, the beginning, or which...
I'd say start from 5.
Start from 5.
I mean, technically, it's the 4th movie in a franchise. I would say it's the 8th, but it's also the 4th. Mm-hmm. Like, if you start watching from 5, or maybe 4, but 4's not great. So I would say, if you have no patience, watch from 5. If you can tolerate a mediocre movie to get you to a great movie, start with 4. But you don't really need to worry about the first 3 unless you really care about, like, some continuity stuff, like little continuity jokes, or if you really want to, like, relive the early 2000s. Like, I will say that when we did our marathon A lot of the people that were, you know, some of the younger people that were in high school in the early 2000s haven't had a really good nostalgia trip from the early movies. I'm not going to say they're great movies, but I will say it's a nice memory lane trip now, because they are like those early movies. Like they seem super hip at the time, but now like they're like the movies your kids will ask you about, like, did you really wear that kind of, you know, it's like how we think about the 80s or the 70s. Like, it's like the bell bottoms thing. But now like kids are going to be like, why do those jeans go all the way to the street, to the floor? Why are the Junko? Why don't they have vowels in them? Like, it's like, you know, it's a relic now. And these movies, like the one we just saw, will probably be a relic at some point too. Not because of fashion sense, but just because of how they made them. I wonder how long the crazy packed huge, like mind-boggling continuity heavy blockbuster universe thing will last. You know, if you want an alternative to the Marvel universe, like this is not far off at this point. If you like big dumb and fun, which also kind of describes The Rock in some places in this film.
Thank you so much for being on the podcast, Matt. Where can people find you?
You can find me at Twitter at @MKEIL. And you can find me if you're on sifted.net, which is SIFTD.net. I do a podcast, a videocast with Shane Satterfield called Game Face every week, usually either Thursday evening or Friday afternoon Pacific time. We talk about the latest news in video games for about 3 damn hours. You have to be a subscriber to watch it on the archive on the site, but you can watch live on Twitch for free.
Very cool. And I am This Game Cheats on Twitter. And I guess if Chris was here, he would say, let's get out of here.